Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome. They came, they killed, and they went. This is Murder 123, and good evening. I'm Dr. John Stamey. I'm so glad to be here with everybody. We've got great guests. We have got great co-hosts, and everything is wonderful. So glad to be here. First of all, I want to welcome our co-hosts. First of all, from Hollywood, California, Devin Tate. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, John. I'm excited to be here with you and Robin and our great guests tonight. I think this is going to be a great new venture.
Well, I agree with you, and thanks a lot. You have done a lot of wonderful things. You've been a co-host of ScaryCast for over a year. We've done a lot of cool things. You're a musician. You're an entrepreneur. You have done wonderful things out there in LA. So we're just so glad to have you. And Robin McCray, one of the best friends anyone could ever have from Columbia, South Carolina. How are you doing tonight?
I am just honored to be on here with you. I think this is going to be fantastic. I am really excited and pumped up about it.
Well, I am too. And other people do these podcasts, but not like we do. We have a lot of fun, first of all. We have a lot of fun, and number two, we talk about the thing that people love the most, which is talking about murder. Murder 1, 2, 3. So tonight, our feature presentation, it kind of came from the Tennessee Bigfoot Conference, and let me explain to everybody how it happened. Okay, so we're up there, and I have a buddy. It was there last year. We liked him and all, and his name was Maverick, and last name not to be discussed. And he said, John, my girlfriend is having a problem. She lives in a building, and she's having some hauntings. I said, really? So he explained it to me, and I said, well, we'll come investigate it. But what he further explained to me is that the building used to be occupied by Al Capone in 1922. Montrose Court opened. And let me tell you a little bit about the history of Montrose Court. It's really spooky, weird, and crime-ridden. I mean, you know, in the roaring 1920s, Johnson City was a hotbed of crime. The streets were full. The sidewalks were full. Lots of stories, lots of shopping. At that time, prohibition made the sale of alcohol illegal. That didn't stop the rows of booze houses in town in Johnson City. In fact, they were surrounded by the mountains full of moonshiners and illegal liquor makers, and it was just a logical thing to occur. I mean, Johnson City was booming because it had three railroads coming within 30 miles of two of the other state lines, and the city's 12 police officers, they couldn't keep up. Can you imagine 12 police officers for a city of about 15,000 people? And prohibition,
it was just nuts.
We heard of all of our lives as Johnson City, referred to as Little Chicago. And there has, you know, there's been a debate about that, but I don't think so. I mean, it was called Johnson City, and it was also referred to as Little Chicago. Major crime marked 1920s in Chicago, as we know. There was alcohol, there was crime, and there was all kinds of growth and development that really happened very rapidly. And then the railroads were going everywhere. So that's what happened. That's what happened in Chicago. And it was happening in Johnson City and everywhere. You know, some of the legendary stories about this city actually had to do with the Chicago and Miami crime bosses. It's, you know, they say it's possible, but it is absolutely a fact that Al Capone was a sometimes resident of Johnson City, Tennessee. He had lots of connections with the moonshiners. And, I mean, you know, So, I mean, what can you do? I mean, that's how Capone made money. Obviously, as a crime boss, he was never convicted of crime. He was convicted of tax evasion. And that really kind of fits in with Al Capone and the crime world. I mean, his business was certainly illegal. And there's a lot of oral history that led to this. Now, the building where he resided was called Montrose Court. And I visited Montrose Court 2 weeks ago. It's kind of a scary looking place. It looks a lot like something in Stephen King's The Shining. And that's what really was interesting to me. So I went through there. I went up there with my friend's girlfriend's condo, and it was a beautiful place. But she said she was having all kinds of paranormal activity. So down there in the basement of Montrose Court was the Montrose Grill. It was very active in the late 20s and early 30s. A little shabby at this point because it's been so many years. Not only was Montrose Court opened in 1922, but it burned in 1928. But it was still around. It was still an active part of the Johnson City, Tennessee area, and, you know, prohibition and the excitement of everything. So we went down there, and Tony Filosi will talk a little bit about this because I sent him, and also Robin, I sent you a little bit of the photographs of down there
yeah.
at the bottom of the building in Montrose Court. So
very
that's
creepy.
What we have. That's what we have. We have, first of all, one of the greatest gangsters and infamous people of all time. We have Al Capone. We have this beautiful, beautiful building, which is actually about six blocks away from East Tennessee State University now. And it is crazy that Al Capone was there, but it's set up so that there was this garage where you could put many, many cars. And, you know, it's funny. I mean, you know, you want to hide cars, you want to hide a building, you build a great garage, and that was built in 1922. So this was a crazy place. So now we have with us, I mean, you know, what we like to do here on Murder 123, we like to bring on someone that is involved in the murder or the mayhem that possibly occurred. One of my very good friends is Janice Carter. Miss Janice Carter, how are you doing tonight?
Doing great.
We're so glad to have you here because you have a real connection to Johnson City and to Al Capone. So you're living now in the South Carolina area, but tell us how you're connected with Al Capone.
Well, my grandfather, Carter, was one of the accountants that helped bring him and his brother Ralph, for tax evasion in the 1930s.
Wow. How lucky could we get? You and your family have been intimately involved with the adventure of Al Capone, and it was a heck of an adventure, wasn't it?
Yes. And not only that, when Capone was released from prison, he also was referred to the John Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, treated for late stages of syphilis. But Hopkins refused to admit him because of his reputation. And John Hopkins is also my relative.
Really?
Yes.
Well, you just connected with everybody, aren't you?
Well, yes and no, but I have the evidence to prove it.
Yes, she spent the last few days going through all this evidence. It's been really exciting on this end to see it.
Absolutely, and I can tell you that some of the evidence that she showed me this past weekend, she's a relative of Tennessee Ernie Ford and all this, so we're just so pleased to have you here. But I tell you what, Janice, this was a really crazy time back in Johnson City. It was known as Little Chicago, and people just went where they were going crazy during Prohibition. I mean, they were drinking all kinds of things that weren't good for them. They would drink these bad concoctions, pure moonshine, and they would get something called the Jake leg, where they would start vibrating and all that, and it was terrible. And because basically it was so much better for the government to regulate alcohol than it was for no regulation at all. I mean, people were dying. They were drinking all these concoctions and all moonshine made from automobile batteries and everything. Terrible.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, they were. So, Janice, tell us a little bit more about your – now, what would he be to you? Because he was your relative. So, what would he be, an uncle, a great uncle, a semi-great uncle? What would he be?
Who? My grandfather?
Al Capone. He was.
No,
Al Capone right,
was not my relative.
Right, but his accountant was your direct
grandfather.
Uncle.
No, my grandfather.
That was grandfather.
Wow.
That was a grandfather.
My grandfather.
Absolutely. And so, what interaction did you have with your grandfather, and what did he tell?
Well, my grandfather raised me from the time I was 4 and a half years old until his death in 1996. And what he told, and through digging through a bunch of junk, I'll tell you what he told me first. He admired Al Capone. He thought that he was wonderful in many ways. And the reason being is because during the Depression, which was pre-Depression for this country, Al started up the soup kitchens in Chicago, and he fed millions up there. He also was a bootlegger, him and his brothers. He was, of course, a gangster. And while my grandfather didn't agree with that spectrum of Al's life, he agreed with the fact that he brought in revenue to people who worked the docks, his brother was known as Bottles, Ralph, as Bottles Capone, and he had many bottling companies, which hired in a bunch of these people that wouldn't have survived otherwise. During the Depression hours, my grandfather also said that he and Al Capone rented an apartment together, and he lived with Al Capone. Now, my great-grandmother on my grandfather's side was a resident at Melrose Apartments.
Wow.
I have pictures. I don't have them here with me, but I have pictures of them standing in the courtyard at Montrose. I'm sorry.
Yeah, Montrose Place. It was called Montrose Court, and the speakeasy that Al ran was called Montrose Grill, and it was downstairs in the very basement of that, and it was just crazy. So many things happened down there because Johnson City, believe it or not, it was called Little Chicago. It was at the intersection of several
major transportation lines.
Exactly, and as we said, they had 12 policemen, and how can you possibly all that?
There's no way.
But now, on the other hand, my grandfather did work for the IRS, and his brother John, who lived in Johnson City at the time with his wife and children, died from alcoholism, John did, because he was a bootlegger.
So he either died of alcoholism or he died of alcohol poisoning from all the all the bathtub gin and everything that was made. And again, one of the great horrible decisions of the United States was prohibition, and when they couldn't police the way that alcohol was made, and you know, they really didn't know that it was going to be such a problem. I mean, you know, when you make bathtub gin, you're just throwing juniper berries in, and you don't know what you're doing. So these poor people that were drinking it, they were dying. It was terrible.
The bad stuff. But now John actually had a still, actually several stills around the area, because if you ever go into the hills in Johnson City and Bristol area, up in Tennessee, and into Wytheville, Virginia, up there, which is not that far away, John had, it's a bunch of hills, it's a bunch of woodlands, and you can still go in there, and it's remote enough that if you set up a moonshine still, you might not ever be found out. So they were making corn liquor. John was making corn liquor, which is White Lightning whiskey, and selling it.
And it was easy
to
sell.
So it all sort of ties in together. While my grandfather was working to bring Al down on tax evasion, his brother was helping him run moonshine.
And, you know, Capone was really not so much an organized crime boss as he was a distributor of liquor. That was
exactly
really what he did.
Because Al Capone only had a eighth grade education.
He did a whole lot for eighth grade education.
He was pretty smart.
He was pretty smart, street-wise, but as far as educated in schools, he was kicked out of school at age 14 because he slapped a teacher or hit a teacher in the face, a female teacher.
Mm.
Oh, wow.
I don't know whether anybody knows that history or not.
Know that. That's a great fact to know.
Yeah. And he originally, Al, was from Five Points, New York, which is Brooklyn. And he ran with gangs in Brooklyn before, you know, he worked at a candy store. He worked in brothels or, you know, prostitute places. He worked at a bowling alley. He, you know, different things that he worked at. He joined up with gangs in New York before he ever moved to Chicago.
Well, you know, that's
really
interesting.
You really kind of wonder this.
Yeah, please go ahead, Robin.
No, I was just going to say, it's really, the first thing that comes to my mind is, you know, with all the activities that he had, like, you know, Jan has knowledge of all these different side things that he was involved in. I wonder if we'll ever really be able to get to the very bottom of just how deep he was in things. I mean, whether it's a legitimate business on the side or more crimes or whatever, I don't think we're ever going to know, because I think he was so diverse in all these different areas that it would be really hard to actually – and he's more well-known, you know, for what we're talking about tonight. But, I mean, you really – I wonder personally just how deep he was in other areas in crime.
He met Johnny Torrio. Torrio, I think I'm saying that right, T-O-R-R-I-O was the man's last name, in New York, in Brooklyn, New York. And Johnny sort of took him out under his wing and became his mentor. And Johnny brought him back to Chicago with him to be his bodyguard and trust a factorium.
I wonder if it would be informative to look into Johnny's background and see kind of where things that he was involved in, and maybe that would give us more insight to things that Al could have been involved in.
Well, Johnny was a gangster too.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. that might, you know, give way a little bit more, because if that's who his mentor was, it only stands to reason that possibly Al could have also picked up some of those extracurricular activities as well.
Well, yeah, I'm sure he did.
Well, you know, I think what we're talking about here are things like The Godfather. And
yeah,
if you remember the movie The Godfather, it's all about crime, and it's all about who you know and who you can control. And, you know, while Capone was never known as a murderer, Capone was always known as the boss. Am I correct, Janice?
Exactly.
He was the boss. And what I can tell you is Zach Somov, the lead artist for Charleston Caricatures, is putting together a picture of Al Capone as the boss. And then he shows up in Johnson City, Little Chicago. What they do is, you know, they run the liquor trade there. And, you know, he uses that as a way, as you told me, Janice, as a way station between Miami and Chicago. And also,
yeah,
you said that they also, and I'll let you speak here in just a second, but you also said there was another way station in Tennessee as well. Please tell us.
That was at Monteagle, let me find the name of the it was called Rye Maybe, R-Y-E, capital M-A-B-E-E, in Monteagle, Tennessee. And he was a influential visitor there whenever, you know, and frequented it going between Chicago and Miami quite often. That's right above Chattanooga, Tennessee, in Middle Tennessee.
Right, so basically not that far, not that totally far from Johnson City. Probably.
No, and you have to consider also that my great-grandparents were, they're actually buried in Johnson City. But anyway, my great-grandparents had places in Johnson City. They also had places in Knoxville, Tennessee. My grandfather had a place in Monroe County, Tennessee. And then you had layovers here and there and yonder. And my grandfather, even after helping get Al prosecuted for tax evasion, was still his friend.
That's amazing.
Strange friends. I tell you what. And Devin, I tell you what, you're out there in Los Angeles, and you are in, and I hate to say this, but you're in a hotbed of crime in that era. I mean, what kind of questions do you have for Janice? Do you have one? I'm sure you do.
God, I'm just, you know, curious if there's any, like, negative energy hanging around still from that incident. You know, with your grandfather involved. What's that?
Negative energy? No, there wasn't any negative energy from that particular incident, because Al never seemed to bother us, but there was some negative energy from other things that my grandfather had been involved in.
Yeah.
Such as?
Well, such as there was a murder that happened on the old farm place back years before my grandparents purchased the property, and the woman, the apparition of the woman, is still there. Also, Sue Hicks' father was also killed on the property, and that was their old home place. And you can see Sue Hicks' father's ghost walking from one particular area at the home place around to where the old homestead cabin sat.
Oh, wow.
And that's the only negative energy. I mean, there was a lot of history and stuff that goes on, you know, in every place that you go to, you know.
Well, I want to say something about that negative energy real quick. And this I can't comment on Jan's situation, but John brought pictures over to my house the other day. And Jan and I were actually supposed to go with him out to that condo.
Montrose place.
And yeah, mm-hmm. And unfortunately, due to time constraints, we were not able to do that. So John went on ahead bravely without us. But he was able to stop by the other night, and he brought some pictures out. And there was so much negative energy in those pictures. I mean, you could almost feel the people that were killed and are probably still buried somewhere down in that basement. That basement.
Yeah, there was
atrocious.
Negative energy. I felt negative
yeah,
energy.
Yeah, I just. When we, yeah, when we, I mean, when Devin asked about the negative energy, I mean, I can't, like I said, I can't comment on Jan's stuff because I didn't have anything to do with that. But when you brought those pictures over here, John, there was so much going on in those pictures. And yeah, it was real dark.
Yeah, it was. And I was down there in the basement. And we'll talk about this more when Tony Filosa gets on here. But I'll tell you what, it was what I would call, it was a mess. And so, because there has been a lot of things that have occurred. There have been, you know, when a lady took a shower, she saw these words written across her shower once the steam hit. And I'll tell you what, there's a lot of things going on there. Montrose Court is a very haunted place. I am convinced of it. And going down there, and it's just crazy. And so I spoke with Tony Filosa, who is coming on here very soon. And you know, it's just a crazy place. But you know, the Al Capone influence in Johnson City, Tennessee is without compare. And we're fortunate that he was there. We're fortunate that it was so interesting. One of you said, you know, there wasn't a lot of bad. I mean, people loved the fact that he brought liquor there.
Yeah,
he was a modern day
Robin Hood. He was considered a modern, Al was considered a modern day Robin Hood to very many people. Because, I mean, he did rob from the other gangsters who were obviously, and mobsters who were obviously rich. And he did feed the poor and gave them jobs.
I mean, that's really cool. You know, the fact that he did that was great. And, you know, only on Murder 123 would we say that. But, you know, Al Capone was a modern-day Robin Hood. It's okay. I mean, and what a lot of people don't know is that once he got out of prison, he lived another 10 years. And he lived with his family, and his family loved him.
And he was married, and his son died when he was young. Sonny did. But, you know, but as far as his wife, him and his wife had a great marriage, and she loved him even though he was a gangster.
Well, I think
the only thing
to show that even the worst people have a certain good side to them. I hate to be the devil's advocate here, but I mean, you know, like Jan said, he did start these soup kitchens. He did feed people. He did give jobs to people that wouldn't have had them. Now, I'm not defending anything on him, but I'm just saying it just shows you that no matter how bad we may think someone is, there may be some part of them that is good.
And here's another thing people don't know, and I can put him there, is, you know, I can say that he was there. During the Valentine's Day massacre, Al was nowhere near Chicago. He was actually in Johnson City.
That's an amazing fact. So he was in Johnson City when the Valentine's Day massacre happened. Gee.
Yep. He was nowhere near Chicago. So there's his alibi. He wasn't even in the city. Now, he may have ordered the hits, but he wasn't there to pull them off himself. He never did his own hits. The only thing he ever did was he cut a woman it was in New York, when he was in New York. He cut a woman in her face, and she cut him back for accosting her. And her brother got in a fight with him, and that was about the end of the story. That's how he got the scars on his face, because of that. And that's why he was called Starlight.
Well, gangsters certainly have incidences that it's hard to explain. We have it.
Well, I think it was
we
harder to pin him on anything because he had henchmen that did all those things. You know, anything, murders or anything like that, he's not going to get his hands dirty. He's going to have somebody else do it for him.
Yeah, I mean, while he, you know, he respected his wife, he respected his mother. His mother was a seamstress in New York. His father was a barber, or whatever you call him, a haircutter, you know. And he respected his mother, he respected his wife. But as far as women that frequented in brothels, you know, that were prostitutes, he had no respect for them. So he thought they were the scum of the earth, which he contracted syphilis from, one of them. And that's what basically caused his rehabilitation mentally, you know, over the years, because he never was treated for it. And he, you know, he didn't treat prostitutes well at all. He thought they were spendable, you know. He could just take them out if they didn't do what he wanted them to do, you know.
Exactly. And I mean,
you respected a lady, but a whore you didn't.
Yeah, exactly. He didn't mind visiting the whores, but he wasn't going to respect them.
No, he wasn't going to respect them, but he didn't mind visiting them.
Nope.
Well, you guys, it's been great talking with you. I'm going to have to jump off this call, but I'm looking forward to the future episodes and have a great conversation for the rest of the show.
Okay.
Well, thanks
a lot,
Devin.
Talking to you again.
Yeah,
thank you.
Glad to have you here. We'll be here next week at Murder 123.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what,
can't wait to talk to you, Devin.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Thanks
bye-bye.
A lot. Well, there you go. One of our great co-hosts, Devin Tate. He has some other things going on, but we were so glad that we had him here. And
yes, we love Devin.
And I just had a text from Tony Filosi. He'll be on here in just a minute. When we start talking about the paranormal events that go here at Montrose Court and Montrose Grill, and I want
yeah,
to kind of recreate.
Cool.
Yeah, and I kind of want to recreate Montrose Grill. Do what?
Yeah, I don't think people realize. I don't think people realize what goes on over there. You know, I mean, now it's used for condos and it's a private area, but I think people don't realize that. Things that went on in the past are still prevalent there.
Yes, they are. And when I was over there and, you know, I was feeling around and, you know, trying to figure out what was going on at my friend's girlfriend's condo. I mean, it was frightening. I mean, you know, there's so many things happening, but we'll say, when Tony gets here, he'll be here in about 5 minutes. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to say, Janice, what else can you tell us about the experience with Al Capone and your family? Because this is fascinating. I mean, it's just not, I'll say this, it's not very often that we get to hear from someone whose family has interacted with a major crime figure. So please tell us.
Well, I have a question for Janice.
Yeah.
I have a question for Janice. Ooh. Not that I can't walk into the next room and ask her, but
okay, go for it.
I want to know. Inquiring minds want to know. You had said, you know, that even after he helped, you know, bring him in for tax evasion, they were still friends. Now, I guess my question, and it's probably a goofy question, but did Al ever really understand that it was your grandfather that helped bring him in?
Yes.
He did? I wondered if he got past that or if, you know, it was just one of those things where he wasn't aware that your grandfather had a hand in it? And then if he did know it, was your grandfather ever concerned about retribution or anything on that?
He was in a way, and it wasn't directly from Al, because my grandfather went to visit Al when he was released from prison. And in Miami, he went back to his Miami home, Al did, for a little bit before he died. He died from a stroke, or actually cardiac arrest that was caused from having a stroke. But anyway, I don't think that it was so much that my grandfather thought there would be retribution by Al or any of Al's family. It was the other gangsters that were involved, because they not only brought Al in and his brother in, and got them on tax evasion, but they also rounded up the rest of his mobsters, his gangsters, and prosecuted them for murder.
Yeah. So it wouldn't be just a one-on-one thing. This would be a whole group that your grandfather, unfortunately, would have to worry about. Yeah, if I were your grandfather, I would feel like I was looking over my shoulder all the time.
Well, I think, you know, and I'm not saying my grandfather was a saint, because Lord knows he wasn't, you know. He may have done some killing of his own, for all I know. I don't know for a fact, but I know that he was in Chicago during 1927, 28, and 29, and he would come back and stay with his family members in Johnson City, Tennessee, with his mother, because he thought the world of his mother. And his father was also a traveling salesman, you know, who traveled all over the place selling products for Perry and Carson. And anyway, you know, and I could put him right there in the midst of things, you know.
Yeah.
But my grandfather also did accounting for Al. And then in later years, after moving to Monroe, Tennessee, my grandfather worked at the aluminum company as an accountant for many years until he retired.
Wow.
I mean, there could have been retribution from any of the other criminals.
Yeah, and not only that,
him.
My grandmother that married my grandfather was from Kingsport, Tennessee. So go figure, you know. I mean, when she taught in Sullivan County, Tennessee, you know, was her first teaching job. And they didn't marry until after all this was amiss. They didn't marry until they were in their 30s. They were both 33 years old.
Now, did she know prior to getting married, did she know all about his involvement with Al Capone?
Yeah.
She did? So she was aware of it.
That when I was going through the letters here, her great uncle, Sam Parker, wrote a letter, and I was reading that letter today, and I thought, oh my God, here we go, you know, because I'm digging for evidence with the very few things that I have here on hand. And he was absolutely, totally against her marrying my grandfather because of his involvement.
I was going to say that would make sense, because, you know, it's such a risky thing. And then, like I said, I mean, after it all went down, anything could have happened. Do you know if your grandfather ever got contacted by anybody after the fact? I mean, did they let him just walk away after that? Or was there problems anymore, you know, in the future down the line?
The only thing I know, and I don't know the details, was at one point my grandfather was sending money to someone, and we never did figure out who he was sending money to. But he was sending about $1,000 every 2 weeks to someone. I don't know whether he was paying somebody off or what he was doing.
Boy, that was a lot of money back
then.
That was a lot of money, especially in the 1960s and 70s when I was little. And my grandmother thought that he had another child or something, that he was paying child support, had an affair, which he had not, you know, and was paying child support to someone. And that was not the case. And then one time when I was little, I don't know who it was, cannot say, I don't know what it was all about, but I know that my grandfather came in one evening and there were shots fired at the house. Someone did a drive-by shooting in rural county, Monroe, Tennessee, in the rural area, and there was nobody on that damn darn dirt road that we lived on at the time. It's paved now, but at the time it was just a wagon trail down to the house. And somebody drove by and shot at the house, put bullets through the house, about 5 bullets, and took off.
Well, and you might not have any information on this, and I know it's really, it's kind of personal, I'm sorry. But, okay, he's sending $1,000 out twice a month. Now,
yeah.
He was an accountant. My understanding, if I'm right, is he was still an accountant at that time.
Yeah.
Did he make that kind of money where he could afford to do that, or do you think maybe he was getting money from somebody else to then send to somebody else?
He made good money.
Did he? I don't know. I was just curious.
Yeah. When they moved, after all this went down with Al, they moved to Monroe County, Tennessee. They bought the property through a bank in North Carolina. Now, I don't know how they did this, but they bought property in North Carolina from Tennessee property. They moved out on this rural farm, and you know, basically in the sticks. And he got a job and he worked with Alco Aluminum Company, you know, until he retired. When I was little, he'd been that with them for 32 years at that point.
Yeah.
When he retired, actually I think it was a little longer than that. But anyway.
Wow.
But anyway, he retired from there, and they put him as Social Security number A, and my grandmother was Social Security number B. They both had the same Social Security number. Now, at the time, they did not have a witness protection program.
Yeah.
My grandfather also changed his name and the date of birth.
Well, that's
what
I was wondering when he moved out there, if it was more to, not just because he liked the countryside, or if it was more as a safety thing.
I think it was a safety thing. I think he was actually hiding away, not, like I said, not from Al's family, but from the other mobsters.
The restaurant, yeah, that's what it sounds like. It really
absolutely
does.
Absolutely it is, yeah.
Well, I mean,
say what,
you know, I don't know of anybody that has, I don't have a Social Security number that lists me as A and then my spouse as B.
I've never heard of
anybody
that
else
at
does.
All. No, that's crazy. I mean, you have it, everybody has their own number and your name is listed on it. You're not listed A and B.
Mm-mm. And you don't change your name to R-I from R-T.
No. And you know,
well, you
and this really,
and you don't change.
This is
your
on topic. Yeah. Well, here's the thing. This is on topic but off topic. When it comes to Social Security numbers, we had a situation a couple of years ago where someone had actually stolen my husband's Social Security number, and I contacted Social Security because I wanted to know if, when all the dust settled and we had to pay off just an enormous amount of debts that were not ours. But I wanted to know what all would it entail to change a Social Security number. And the red tape that goes along with that is just so extreme. It was mind-boggling to me. I mean, it's definitely not something you just flippantly do, let alone change the name or anything or a birth date. And especially to have done it way back then. You know, I mean, it might be easier than it was now, but that was just not something so easily done.
Yeah.
Wow. Absolutely amazing. It's a tough question, and I'm sure it was a tough situation for you, Robin. And by the way, I want to introduce who has just now come on, Tony Filosi, one of our favorite paranormal.
Tony,
how are you doing?
Hey. I'm doing fine. How are you guys doing?
Good.
Great to have you.
Oh, it's good to be here. It's a great show. It's super interesting.
Thanks a lot for being here. Because we were talking about, you know, the fact that I went through the Montrose Court building, and there were so many so many bad vibes there. There really were. I guess that's the way to say it. So, you know, and you have looked at a couple of the photographs that I sent you, and just wanted, you know, and now one thing that we like to talk about here on Murder 123 is the paranormal adventures when we go to it. Now, you have gone to a number of places where you've had bad vibes and everything, and, you know, kind of like what we have here. So what is, in your experience, you know, what have you done to investigate places like this? And then we'll talk about the photos that I sent you. And I sent the same photos to Robin and everything.
Well, usually what I do, John, is the first thing you do is you go in and get you a baseline. You check the EMF, see if there's any old wiring or anything. So a lot of times if there's old wiring, you'll have what's called, and you have a lot of EMF bleed through, you have what's called a fear cage, and it'll give you the feeling that you're being watched, paranoia. You can get some paranoia going on, especially if it's a cramped, dark place. So that's the first thing we do, is make sure there's none of that going on. Then we usually set up and do EVP sessions and see what, with, you know, questions that pertain to the property or to a person that lived there at the property, and see if we can get any responses from there, and then we keep building the case that way.
Okay, and when you're talking about EVPs, you can talk about recording those, or you can use basically a spirit box, correct?
Yes, you can use a spirit box, or you can use a digital recorder, you can use old-time tapes. I mean, there are several different ways to record them, but EVP is an electronic voice phenomenon, and usually it comes in above or below the range of human hearing. I believe they more come in at infrasound level, below the range of human hearing, but usually for this, we will use some type of digital recorder. I'm kind of partial to Sony's and Tascam's. Now, if you want to do something beyond that, then you use a spirit box. And what a spirit box does is it cycles through radio frequencies and creates white noise. And there's frequencies inside that white noise. Some people will claim it's EMF. Some people, you know, like me, I just think it's a frequency that the entities can use to amplify their voices for communication. And I've had a lot of success both ways. You know, Halloween night, we did an investigation in the old Harlan County courtroom. I think y'all remember a little bit about Manzo Shepherd, and we got some EVPs. Really good EVPs from the old Harlan County courtroom used that method the other night.
I'd love to hear those.
They were some really good ones. It was some of the best I've called in a while. They really were.
Good.
There was this, really quick, I'll tell you, you know, one of the reasons I like asking questions that pertain to a subject or something that's happened at the location is that way when you get a response that validates that, the statistical probability of that randomness coming through a radio station is little to none. You're more likely to win the lottery twice that week. But there was a situation here in Harlan that's been going on for a few months with mines didn't pay their miners. It's been all over the news and national news. It's called the Black Jewels, the name of the mines. So this was an interactive affair we had on Facebook. and one of the Black Jewel folks, which we'd given us some tours of the jail that's there in that same building, said, "Hey, ask Manzo, does he remember the Black Jewel ladies, which were the wives?" And as soon as I asked the question, the response came through. I mean, just super clear, and repeated back, "Black Jewel."
Mm-hmm.
So
oh wow!
That's
pretty cool.
Yeah, it was pretty convincing right there. So
wow,
I'd love to do that over that house.
Oh yes, that's very possible. All you have to do is
wouldn't it be
tell
amazing?
Oh yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
I'd be anxious to see what we could pick up.
So
oh yes,
out of curiosity, Tony, could you actually do one and see if you could get any relatives or Al Capone to answer?
Yes. Sure. We just have to, you know, the names and some historic facts, you know, and then I'll frame the questions to where that, you know, if they would get responses.
You need to do that.
You know, oh, yeah.
Well, and Jan's got enough information about him where you'd be able to ask some really good questions.
Yeah. For instance, a lot of people don't know that Al was actually arrested in Philadelphia, PA, you know, back in spent 9 months in the state penitentiary up there for carrying an unlawful firearm, you know. But they decked
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they decked his suit out up there. You know, he had Tiffany lamps and everything else, and a couch and everything else in his prison cell.
Oh my God!
Wow.
That's something a lot of people probably don't know.
You know, I should not know all these things.
Yeah,
but
you should. I'm glad you did.
You know, and when they arrested him for tax evasion, guess where he went to first? He went to Atlanta Penitentiary in Atlanta, Georgia. Then he went to Alcatraz. And
right.
In every place that he was held, his cells were decked out with luxury.
And, you know, you wonder how, I mean, you know, you think when you send a criminal to prison or any type of a, you know, secured facility like that, they wouldn't be living better than you are.
Maybe they would be.
Yeah. I guess if you're Al Capone and you've got that kind of money, you'd be amazed what it can happen.
Exactly. So, you know, Tony, it's wonderful that you have brought up, you know, how we can investigate this. And I sent you these photographs, and I sent the same photographs to Robin. So, first time in the world. Well, I just sent them.
I looked at them, and I got hung up on the Montrose place there. Because I said, "Oh my God, I got pictures of my grandmother, great grandmother, and my great aunt Anne standing in that place, and I even have their apartment in that place, the inside of it." You know, I was like, "Holy crap!"
So let's do it in this order. Tony, what did you think about those photographs of the luminescent blue object, and then we're going to ask Robin the same question. So, Tony, what do you think?
Well, I've gotten several of those photographs, probably a dozen or so in the last 12, 15 years. Usually what the blue light is it's a lens, it's a type of lens flare, or it's a light anomaly where your shutter's not open quick enough, because in total darkness your shutter needs to come open and stay open for a longer period of time without moving. So when that shutter comes open and you move slightly, it will give the appearance a lot of times of rods, of energy rods and things like that, which I have caught orbs and things, but they're few and far between, and they are you know, they are self-illuminating, which those appear to be, but I've seen, and it, what's odd about it is usually what I've caught whenever it was something inky with the camera was the color blue. I've caught things where that it actually looked like a vortex coming up out of the, you know, I mean, I was all excited about that one. You know, vortex, we were doing an EVP session, and it looked like a vortex was under a table, and it was some sort of crazy reflection, because when I blew it up, you could see us, it was inverted in the, and I can't explain how the camera what I just tell you what I found, but I don't know that, you know, I can't say that you caught a photograph of energy. You know, I can't say you did. I can't say you did, but I can tell you from my experience that those catching orbs or energy rods are few and far between, especially when you're shooting in super low light or darkness. You didn't have a flash or anything on that camera, did you?
No, we didn't.
Okay, just to see. So, you know, that's my opinion. I could be wrong, but, you know, I've ran this by three separate other individuals besides myself that have, and all of them have more experience with photography than I do. And they all agree that it's probably some sort of lens flare, light anomaly, something like that.
Well, I don't even okay. take decent pictures, so I don't fool with cameras.
And I'm not saying there wasn't negative. I'm not saying there wasn't energy down there. I just don't know that you caught it in a photograph.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now, Robin, I sent those pictures to you. What do you think they were?
Okay. I tend to agree with Tony as far as what the blue light was. But here's what I got out of the picture itself, which is a little bit off base. Number one, just the picture itself, you can feel the different energies in it. And I'm not talking just one energy. There was several. Two energies I picked up that were stronger than the others that were there. And the one, it shows, like, you have the hand and it where the blue light was at, and it kind of squiggled all over. And there was this blue strap on that was from whatever light source that this person was using. But when you go past the hand, okay, and you can't see, I'm not going to say that you can see a figure or anything there because I really didn't see it, but I can feel the energy pull there. And it was a dark energy. Now, there was another one. If you were looking at that picture off to the right, a little bit farther back, there was a second one that really was prominent. There was others, but these are the two most prominent. That one was dark, but not as bad as the one that was closest to the hand that had the light in. And that was just really bad. And it felt
John
to me like it was kind of, huh?
Robin, when John was here the other night, he showed me those pictures on his cell phone. And I remember that one. If you go to the far left-hand side of that photo,
yeah,
there is a dark box area.
Yeah, there is. Now, I'm talking about the one that was the close-up. That one didn't have the box theory in it, but I remember what you're talking about, and it absolutely was there because we both commented on it.
Yeah, because we got dark energy.
Yeah, exactly. This one was a close-up of more or less just the arm and the hand that was holding it. It looked like it had been blown up and maybe cropped. But just off that hand going straight back, it was really, really dark, and it felt like it was trying to pull energy from whatever light source that was.
Mm-hmm.
Now, like I said, the light source, it had a blue strap on it. I put it on photo editor and blew it up and kind of tried to, you know, get a little bit better clue on it. And it looked like whatever kind of light he had was on a blue strap. And I agree with Tony that the lens blur could have been why it looked like squiggly lines, or not lines, but like a squiggly tube coming off of it that was blue.
Yes.
But you could also feel from the entity that was behind that hand, or in front of it, actually, it was trying to pull the energy from that light. So I think that it was a combination. I think that Tony's absolutely right, but I also think that part of the problem was this entity was trying to pull the energy from it as well.
And like I said, that one was really dark. And there was another one behind it that was dark, but not as bad. There were some off to the side. But Jan is right, too, because that one picture that we looked at that John had brought over had that big dark area in the back.
Yeah.
And that thing was just hate. I mean, that was pure evil coming out of that black box or that blackened area. But that one in front of him wasn't a whole lot better. Like, that whole basement is loaded.
Mm-hmm. Well,
if you were to go down there, they would be right on top of you trying to suck every bit of energy out of you. But I think John said when he was there, you had walked into some cold pockets down there, didn't you?
Absolutely, I did. There were like three. Oh, my God, it is so cold right here. And I brought my friends, and they said, yes, it is. And then you go out outside of that area. And it was not cold. But yeah, there were three times in that exploration that it was absolutely freezing.
Yeah, and see, for me, like when I looked at the pictures, you had originally sent them to me and said, check out this blue light. Let me know what you think. And for me, it went past that blue light because I got more that I picked up around the whole area than just that light. But I think Tony's right on what happened with the light as far as, you know, the lens and all that. But there was a lot of really dark stuff down there. And you could just, the energy from that just came right out of the picture, like somebody was going to slap you with it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I wanted to explain this to people. Because Maverick, my buddy, who has the actual blueprints of that building, there are several places that you cannot get into that it's amazing. And I said, you know, you probably don't want to, like, take a pickaxe and get into those the concrete walls of those 3x3. No, because holy smokes, you would not believe what could really happen.
Well, and when you told me about that, I kept getting all these mental pictures of all these different people, and they were all in these contorted positions, like buried within these walls or directly behind them.
The one I got a bad feeling about was the drum, the 55-gallon drum barrel.
Yeah.
That was where I got the worst
high bodies
feeling.
In those.
Looking at that, I thought, oh, my God, there's somebody in that darn barrel.
Yeah. But I think
I'm sorry.
The condos are there.
Now, with the barriers there, we might not can go through the barriers, but if we're running a EVP session, they sure can come to us from the barriers.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was wondering, too. I mean, they can, you know, spirit-wise, they can get out just because that's their final resting place, good or bad. I mean, you could be able to do that with the EVP.
Yeah,
it's just like when we were talking on the one that Don Tart had in Georgia there. I mean, the little girl came through, the man came through, the Native Americans came through, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that was interesting.
Exactly.
But I think, you know, now that they're they've redone this building for these condos, and, I mean, it's just like the perfect storm. Because they're in there tearing things apart and rebuilding and unsettling everything. And now people have moved in and things are going to start happening. I mean, we already know that it's going on with Maverick's girlfriend.
Exactly.
How many people else, those buildings that we aren't aware of that are going through this? Because it's not going to be just in one place. That whole building has got so much history and 90% of it is bad. And I know for a fact, just like Dan does, there's people buried down there.
Yeah, I know. I know there's people buried down there. Just by looking at pictures, I know.
Absolutely.
And so now
they're going to go in there, and they've redone it, which is lovely, and people are very happy to move in there and purchase these condos. But what about the dead? They're still there, and I guarantee you, 99.9% of those people in those condos have no clue what they just walked into. Either they don't believe it, their minds aren't open to it, or they don't know the history.
Right. But also, Robin, the energy will be absorbed into the building itself. You know, that will absorb into the stone and the wood and you know, all that whatever happens, you know, whether somebody lost their life there, whether it was just a traumatic event,
yeah.
Whenever that discharge of energy happens, that building will hold it, or the grounds will hold it.
It will. And I want to say one other thing on the negative energy, and Jan and I deal with this all the time, and Tony, I know you probably know about it, and I know John does too, but I'm just going to put it out there. Negative energy draws negative energy. So whatever's going on in that building, we know it's dark, is like a neon beacon for everything out there to come in on the negative energy because they feed on it.
Yeah.
So not only do you have negative energy in the building, you have other beings and other whatevers out there that are going to be drawn to that because it's like a buffet. They literally feed on it. That's how people get these entities attached to them because they possibly have got dark energy or they're depressed or they're upset or whatever, and they're drawn to that for that reason, and then these other beings feed off of it.
Yeah,
I
and I don't
so
like
however,
any claim, and Robin doesn't either, to be inside.
No, I don't
anything.
Either.
But
no, I don't
we
either.
Do, we do pick up on stuff. We have gifts. Yeah, it's the only way I know how to explain it. That, you know, we're gifted in some ways that other people aren't, and we do pick up on things.
Well, and it's like in the last, and this is just being honest, and I'm not making this up, and I you know, I don't claim to be anything, but in the last 48 hours, I've had three people get hold of me over negative entities that they think that are around them. And it's like, you know, I keep telling them, one in particular, I keep telling her, you know what, this stuff is coming to you because you've got to get it together. Like, you have got this dark energy around you, and you're just feeding everything. That's all you're doing. You're a buffet.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have even the buildings, and like Tony said, the stone and the wood, that's all going to absorb that negative energy, but all it is a big buffet.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell you
a
story. And Tony, you may know this. Okay, during the Great Fire of Chicago, almost everything burned except a very few places. Okay, I obtained in 2007 one of the entryways to one of those buildings. It had been turned into a bookcase, and I bought that in Indiana. Hauled it all the way to Tennessee to put in my antique shop. It had dark energy, and this thing was sturdy. I at first set it in my house, and I thought, oh, I'll keep it because it's a part of history. It fell over and like to crush my youngest daughter, who is here now with me. And I thought, okay, this thing is going into the shop. I'm going to sell it. People would come into the antique shop and take one look at it and said, no. I ended up practically giving this thing away for $50.
I mean, dark energy attracts more dark energy. It's a vicious cycle. So you've got all these things that happened in that house. And, you know, I think it's relatively safe to say, and we all can agree, that there are probably people buried in that house, or at least people that lost their lives in that house. And now you've got these other people that are innocently enough have bought them and are living there.
Mm-hmm.
But that energy is still there. It doesn't matter if it's absorbed into the brick or the wood or anything else. It's still simply there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you've got to deal with all that baggage, plus whatever else it's bringing in.
And that parallels Bobby Mackey. That's parallels almost to a T experience I had at Bobby Mackey's, where that the mob actually, Cleveland mob, you know, and there was a lot of negative energy in Bobby Mackey's basement.
I know that. I remember that story of that.
And that is because the mob, that's where they took the people to do bad things to them and take them and dump them in the river. And that's what people really, that's the part of history a lot of them really don't get about Bobby Mackey's. It's not about the Pearl Bryan and all that that mess, which is, you know, they got the history wrong. But it was about the mob and what they did and a whole lot of other things
yeah.
going on. And that dark energy just kept building. I do believe that you know, that dark brings dark.
It does. It absolutely does.
So that makes
but on the other hand, light brings light. But most of them that go to the light, so to speak, do not care to come back and entertain us.
I mean, yeah, it's just one of those things that, you know, and the light is supposed to run out the dark
mm-hmm.
if it's done correctly. But, you know, it's still the dark is there, and if it's not being dealt with, if it's not, you know, nothing has been cleansed and it's still there and it's absorbed into everything, it's just a hotbed. And it's not like there's any end in sight. But now we've got these people that are living in these condos and have put, you know, forth their money and their life savings or whatever into these beautiful new condos. And they're just kind of like sitting ducks. And a lot of them won't even realize what's going on because they're not in the mental state to be open up to that kind of paranormal activity.
Exactly.
But what happens, and I've seen it happen before, and I'm not saying it happens all the time, but I have seen it happen, they blow up their life, and these people don't realize why their lives are blowing up. Everything's going wrong, and they're fighting with friends and spouses and, you know, partners or whatever, and they don't understand why their lives are exploding, and they're so busy wondering about that, they still aren't comprehending that a lot of it can be paranormal. Because this dark energy wants the turmoil. It needs the turmoil to eat. You know, I mean,
yeah.
It feeds off of it. And it's just a vicious circle.
Yeah. So, John, did you get a hold of Maverick about health issues there?
Well, not exactly. I mean, we just like... went through there and we saw the, you know, we saw the, how can I put it? We saw the variety of problems there, and that's
mm-hmm.
what we saw. We didn't really go through that, but that's something we want to do. And Tony is going to come down, and we're going to do that. And
yeah.
Hopefully, you guys can, you know,
oh,
come
definitely.
Down and do that, because this is like a veritable feast of problems at Montrose Court, right,
yeah.
Tony?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But yeah, I'd be glad to come over and run an EVP session and do, you know, do a baseline around the EVP session. Well, it sounds
I'd
like
love
a,
to do the EVP session. I am all for that. You all can take the pictures.
I mean, it's really interesting.
Oh, I definitely am. Count me in.
Well, you know, when we're talking about murder 123, we're talking about serious problems and potentially psychic problems that we can track and everything. And that's what we want to do. And that's why with some people today, I was talking about it. This is like part one of this wonderful investigation. Because I'll tell you what, there's some crazy things going on at Montrose Court. And we want to try to investigate them.
Well, if I might say something on that, I mean, when you talk about the murder 123, people also just seem to think that once there's been a murder or a death or whatever, it's over and done with. It isn't. It's just the next chapter it goes into, especially when it's a murder. I mean, nobody wakes up in the morning and says, hey, I'm getting murdered that day. So it's sudden, it's unforeseen, but there's more to it. It's so much deeper than just it happened, it was long ago, because it lingers. And Tony knows this better than probably anybody because of the research and investigations he does.
Mm-hmm.
There may be a death, but that's just the first step.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to last for a long time after.
Yeah. I mean, I've been to places, you know, that had historical entities still there in places, you know, like Civil War and everything else, Revolutionary War, and they're still there. They still are lingering.
Yeah. We had, when I was in Michigan, we had, I had taken some pictures outside, and I was actually not trying to get a spirit or a ghost. I was just taking a picture of my collie, and I get this picture back, and there's a soldier standing in it. I mean, it was the craziest thing. I mean, I knew there were spirits around there as well as other cryptids and other things, but I was really, at the time, I was just simply taking a picture of the dog.
Yeah.
And
Tony,
he was literally standing behind her.
I want to get his view on one thing, if I might. Tony, are you still with us?
I'm still here.
Okay. It's been back a while back, 2000 and I'm trying to think, 9, I think. Might have been 8. No, it's 2008. At any rate, I was in Wayne National Forest up in Ohio, and we were out there doing other investigations. We weren't trying to look for ghosts or anything. However, mm-hmm. a friend of mine was running the thermal imager, and another friend was running the camera. And mm-hmm. we were out there at the night of the night, and both of them got these hooded, three figures that were hooded, ghosts. On the regular camera, they came through as black shadow figures, you know, on the in the flash of the camera. And on the thermal, it came through, they were doing filming on the thermal, and it came through as white, ghostly, see-through figures in these hooded cloaks. What would be your take on those?
I don't know. I mean, it could possibly be shadow people, you know, because sometimes they'll try to, when they come through, they'll have hats and they'll have capes and different things. But I wouldn't, I don't know. I've not ran into that before out.
I mean, this was in a national forest. I mean, there wasn't any buildings or anything around.
I've never ran into that. That's very unusual.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, Tony, do you get a lot of the apparitions in your investigations, or do you get primarily the EVPs?
The EVPs, most of them. You know, we have cameras set up, and we'll do some photographs, but I don't do a lot of photographs because it's such a low percentile thing.
Yeah.
You'll shoot 1,000 photographs, and you might catch one or two maybes, you know. So many variables.
Any of the ones I've gotten on photographs have been an accident. It wasn't that I was trying to get them. They just showed up.
Yeah.
Well,
I happened to be taking a picture of something else.
We weren't trying to get these ghosts.
But on film, you know, I've caught things moving, doors opening, closing, things coming off of shelves and, you know, things like that. I like dealing with video way more than I do still photos because I can always pull a still photo from my video.
Right.
And study it
right.
Further, you know. So I like dealing with video more than I do photographs, and you know, not saying that you can't catch things with photographs, because I know there's been some really great photographic evidence caught. But you know, as far as me, I don't do near the. You know, I would do photos of the structures, and when we do a walkthrough, you know, a lot of times we'll video it or take photos that way. At the end of the investigation, you can do the same thing again and see if anything's moved out of place, if anything's been knocked over, if it's, you know,
yeah.
You know, things of that nature.
Well, out of curiosity, do you ever ask the ghost that you're speaking to on the EVP or get down, cat. Hold on a minute. Cat's in my face. At any rate, on the voice EVP, is that what it's called?
Yes.
Okay. On those, do you ever ask the ghost to turn on a light or dim the lights or move something?
Make a noise
or something?
You know, it may be 2 or 3% of the time they'll do that. They're strong enough to do that. I've had them move roll balls slightly, knock on walls, open slam doors, with force. A lot of different things like that.
I was at work. Yeah, I know. It goes on here a lot. Tony, you would have a ball here. I'm telling you, it's a crazy house. I was at work one time. This was years ago. This was back in, 2004, 2005. And work hadn't started yet. I was a mortgage broker. And we had, 5 or 6 of us sitting in an office talking before the day started. And we were sitting there. And one of the girls I was sitting next to had a cup of coffee on the desk. And this cup of coffee literally scooted across the desk. And it was hysterical because every man in that room flew out of there. I was the only one left. There was me and the girl sitting there, and she's looking at me going, tell me that didn't just do that. And she's like, you're not freaking out. And I was like, come to my house. Stuff goes on all the time. But it did it. It literally moved a full cup of coffee all the way to the other side of the desk.
Wow.
But now when we were at the Georgia Bigfoot Conference, a very dear friend of mine had rented us a house for that weekend, and it was out in the woods, and we're in the house. We're getting ready to leave, and I was packing, and every time I'd go to start, now there was a ceiling fan in the bedroom, and that had been on the entire time we were there. The chain never moved. It never wiggled, nothing. There were 2 long chains hanging. Every time I'd start packing up my suitcase, these chains would get so swinging violently that the one wrapped around the globe. It was out of control. I was afraid it was going to, because at the base of it had these, looked like a gold knob, and I was afraid it was going to break the light. It was so wild. And I packed my suitcase, and it did it the whole time. And it kept going. It was just like it was picking up speed. And I stopped because I forgot something, and I opened the suitcase, and I had to take stuff out of it to get it out. And as soon as I started taking things out of the suitcase, it stopped to a dead stop, and it didn't move. And I thought, this is so bizarre. So then I got done getting what I had accidentally put in the suitcase out, started to pack it again, and it kicked it right back up again. I actually videotaped it the second time. The first time I was so startled, and I was just convinced that it was going to break that ball. I never thought to report it, but I did get it the second time.
Well, Robin, when we were there, the night before was when we did the EVP session with the little girl and the man that had been captured by the Indians. And I asked her, and we never did get, we even heard drumming, Native American drumming, when you were sitting over on the couch and me and Don was over there, and we looked at each other like, holy crap, you know. But anyway, I had asked her that if she wanted to continue our conversation, because I could tell that she was getting weak, to take and dim the lights when she was ready. Now, I don't know if that was a sign from her or a sign from the Bigfoot with the
chain. Yeah, I don't know, because when she quit talking on the EVP box, she would talk, and she would mind speak, and she would say, I'm just getting too weak. I just can't do this. I'm too weak.
Yeah.
I don't know how to make myself strong enough. I'm just too weak. So, I talked to her then, and it was, not a problem, but it was just very bizarre because that ceiling fan had been going since we got there 3 days before, and that chain, neither one of the chains on it had ever moved.
No.
And then it was such a drastic contrast because, like I said, I thought it was going to break the light. And it was just tall enough where I couldn't reach it.
After we had stopped talking and went to bed, remember I came in there and sat in your bedroom for a little bit, and we saw that dark shadow thing run across the floor. downstairs.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, it was crazy. But I've never lived in a house that I didn't have this kind of activity.
Yeah. And before we even started the EVP section, Don and I was out on the porch, and we were drawn to that house across the way that was totally dark. Nobody was in it. And we both of us said, oh, we're getting the negative energy from that, you know. Hello, John. Did you go to sleep?
Absolutely not. I was just listening. And I was just trying to figure out what we're talking about here, because this is, like, really cool. I mean, no, Dr. John has not gone to sleep. He was, like, listening, and it's amazing what we're doing. Because, you know, when we're talking about murder 1, 2, 3, we're talking about the standard stuff that people hear about in the in the newspapers and stuff, and we have a lot of those. But when we're talking about this, we're talking about the psychic things that happen. It's amazing, and that's kind of what we're doing. And we only have 3 minutes.
We started with Al Capone and the history behind him, but I mean, it will lead in. You know, maybe we could do some investigation just out of curiosity. You know, because I like doing weird stuff. But at any rate, that's all more than obvious. Big investigations. But anyway, if we could actually go back to some of these places where we've had things occur that were not Bigfoot related.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I've already talked with Tony about coming down to Johnson City. Right, Tony?
Oh, absolutely.
And so what we can do is we can go to, and you know, and this is why Murder 1, 2, 3 is not, this is not exactly the standard comic, you know, we're going to do all this. No, we're going to go down there and investigate what's going on.
Yeah.
And so we'll,
Tony can
we'll
come
do
and do that.
That
EVP. That'll be fabulous.
Right. So we'll do that. And there's some things that I don't want to reveal about this site. And Tony, I mentioned those to you a couple of days ago. There are some problems with this site. And so what we'll do, you know, we'll all gather together, and as Janice Carter said, we'll just do a ghost box outside the place because there may be some problems. And Janice, you remember we talked about that, right?
Yes.
So we'll do it. So what I want to say is, with 1 minute and 47 seconds left, I want to thank all of our guests and all of our hosts. I want to thank Devin Tate, who had to get out of here. I want to thank Robin McCray. I got guests, Janice Carter and Tony Pelosi. Oh, and
yeah,
there
thank
is.
Thank you guys for being here. You're both amazing.
Yes. Thank everybody.
Exactly.
Thank you very, very much.
I want to thank all of you. And now next week we'll have another guest, another crazy Murder 1, 2, 3, where we. It's just all real, and we're trying to figure out how we're going to investigate these things. So thanks to everybody. I really appreciate it. And, oh, my God, there's 60 seconds. There's the bitch lady. So thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks,
we
everybody.
Will be
Take
back.
Care.
We'll be back. Ladies and gentlemen, Murder 1, 2, 3. Take care.
All right.
Bye.
See you guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.